Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I am Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I am Tor Norby from the Android Tools team. And today we have a guest.
And I'm Chiu Kyu Chen.
From which team at Android?
I'm an independent developer, so
what?
No team.
How did you get in the building? This is badge access. What are you doing here?
I rang up this guy called Chad and asked him to pick me up at the lobby, and he showed up.
We got to get rid of that guy. Obviously, this is where security leaks are coming from. So, who are you? No, we covered that. What do you do? Why are you here talking to us on an Android Developers Backstage podcast?
I am an Android developer.
Yeah, that's requirement number one.
Right. I've done a lot of various things, but I believe I was invited here because I give talks at conferences. I talk about different ways of doing Android, a lot of advanced technique, I would say. And people seem to like what I do.
Is it the talking part or the developing part?
Well, it's hard to tell because I talk about developing, you see.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, actually, that's the interesting part is there are a lot of people who give talks who don't necessarily understand what it is they were talking about.
Mm.
But the talks that I've seen that you have given, clearly you did the work ahead of time, so you actually knew what was going on. And the talks have interesting technical details that seemed worth diving into.
What are some of the talks you've given and what are the topics?
One of the talks that I've given earlier on is Android custom components. So it talks about how do you override custom views? How do you make a custom view group and what are the functions available like onDraw or onInflate? No, it's not called onInflate. What is that called?
OnMeasure?
OnLayout, onMeasure, those kind of things.
People get those confused because when you're doing layout, it can inflate the time that it's taking to render the frame.
Right.
I think that's it. Yeah.
That must be why I was confused.
Yeah, must be. Okay, so custom view groups. So there's custom views and there's custom view groups. Custom views, like the simplest custom view is you basically override on draw and you draw whatever you want.
That's not the simplest. No.
Okay, the simplest.
You have not actually
simplest
watched
my talk. And that's not even a required function. Basically, you need to override the constructors and then you're done.
That's right.
Okay, so that's the simplest.
So, you know, I actually have extended button and just basically in the constructor you call set text with the thing. And then now you have a component that you don't have to configure at all. It just has a hard-coded string. Not super useful, but it is simpler than overriding onDraw.
Right.
Okay, so I want to lay down a new rule for the podcast just going forward. Just don't countermand anything I say. It's just it's very hurtful.
When are we going to start recording, by the way?
Okay, so the next simplest view group, the custom view that I tend to implement in my simple demos and apps where I'm trying to demonstrate a particular point is you override onDraw and you do custom drawing.
Right.
Right. So you have a handle that canvas object, and then you can draw some lines or text or whatever
right.
in the absolute position that you want within that view. View group is like the next advanced level.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when do you do that, and what are the other things that you need to handle when you're actually dealing with a group that has children in it?
So like for view group, it's, like you said, it has children in it. I mean, that's the main difference between a custom view versus custom view group. I tend to look at it as something that you want to do on top of the children or under the children, if that makes any sense. So for example, when you override onDraw on a view, you are changing the look and feel of the view. But what if you just want to, say, have a bookshelf that's actually just a grid view? You just want to draw the shelf underneath the views. If you think of it initially, you probably think, why would I need custom view for that? I can just put a background graphic, right? Then it will look like a bookshelf. It will look very nice, except when you scroll, then the books will start falling off the shelf because this background is static and then the scrolling will happen on top. So that is the moment when you need to go into, for example, a custom view group, and then you need to adjust the positions depending on, you need to draw the background depending on the position of your scrolling.
Okay. So that's still dealing with like purely the drawing functions of it, but then there's also the children, right? So once you are a custom view group, you are responsible for actually managing the children. It's like you mistakenly in the universe became a parent, and then all of a sudden you're actually responsible
for
the results of that.
Knowingly becoming a parent when
hopefully,
you override
hopefully
the view group.
That's the goal.
Actually, that reminded me of something. I remember when I first tried to do a custom view group, I forgot to override. Well, I overrode the on layout function, and then I forgot to ask the children to lay themselves out, so it's empty. like, wait, nothing's happening. And yes, you are right. You're absolutely right. You need to take care of your children, whether you get into parenthood.
Otherwise, like not. CPS steps in.
That's I'm not sure the Android equivalent of that, but
probably exceptions and crashes.
Right. Yeah. So, for example, you may write a view group that you want to position the children in a more fancy way, right? Maybe you want to fan them out rather than having them just one after another, like linear layout. So at that point, you will take the children and then you will compute the XY coordinate for each of them on screen depending on your algorithm. The nice thing about doing that in a custom view group is that you can still specify your children in XML. So you can think of it just like having a linear layout, and you have the opening tag, and then you have the text view and the button and whatnot under, and you close it. You can have the same thing, except you replace the linear layout with your custom view group. So you don't have to actually have a separate mechanism of defining your children.
Okay. So how often do you do a full-on custom view group where you then do need to deal with the children in on layout and measure and all that stuff versus just overriding or subclassing linear layout? So you let one of the standard layouts sort of handle all those details?
Almost never, to be honest. Yeah. I usually override a custom view group when I need to, for example, override the touch interceptor?
Yep.
Interceptor, I think. So for example, sometimes I want it so that I have a map underneath, but then I don't want people to muck with it until they did some other action, right? So I will have a custom frame layout, for example, and I will override the on touch intercept function and say, okay, don't let the touch events pass onto my children until, you know, maybe I keep some internal state until this other event has happened. So most of the time, I actually don't use the drawing function, like you were saying. Like, I don't override the drawing function at all. I just let whatever view group that I inherit, whether linear layout or frame layout, to do their job, but then I change the behavior very slightly with my own logic.
So if you wanted to have, for that specific example, you want to use like a web view, mm-hmm. but you wanted to use it in read-only mode. So you what did you do? You took make it a child of a frame layout,
exactly.
But then you make the frame layout not pass its touch events through to its children. That's what you do?
Exactly.
Okay. So, interesting.
Yeah. Black box it.
Yes. Are there any tips and tricks related to custom views that you include in your talk?
Rule number one is pick the view that's closest to what you need to do. So, for example, like you were mentioning earlier, if all you need to do is that I want this button to always say one thing, then override the button class. Don't override view class and draw your own button and handle all the different press state and whatnot, because there's already done that work. So don't repeat whatever that's already done for you. So that will be kind of the rule number one.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is just that sometimes it sounds a little bit cheesy, but I will actually take a piece of paper and imagine that's my canvas. Because a lot of the operations that you do may involve translation and rotation. And if you are just doing it on paper, you may, I don't know, maybe some people are very good at visualization in their head and the coordinate and whatnot. But for me, I remember I was doing this view, what I call a sideways layout. So it's a linear layout that in the dispatch draw function, it actually rotates the view before you draw it so that I can have, say, a bookshelf where the books are actually, you know, the words are on the spine, so the writings are vertical rather than horizontal. Mm-hmm. The first time I did that, I was like, okay, fine, I'll rotate it by 90 degrees, done. And then nothing appeared on screen. And I was like, what is happening? Then I actually took out a piece of paper and then, well, I read the documentation. So when you rotate, it actually rotated pivoting at 0, 0. So I stick my finger at 0, 0 and I rotated the piece of paper and haha, it's off frame. So when I rotated the view, I also need to translate it back down because when I rotated, it went off the screen. So I found that very helpful to actually imagine, not even imagine, like actually take a piece of paper and that's your canvas when you're trying to operate on it.
It's funny because I had the exact same issue. I recently also wanted vertical text.
Ah.
And so, but I didn't use paper. What I did was, you know, whenever I saw 90 degrees, I thought, let me go down to 10 degrees. And of course, then I saw it.
Right.
But it was like barely rotated.
Right.
So, yeah, okay, it's going off screen.
It's the beauty of doing computer graphics, though. Like, eventually you can see the bug. Instead of just like trying to intuit what's going on in that database transaction, you're like, no. Actually, things are upside down and flipped around. Okay.
Right. You can simulate that pretty easily.
Tweak things until it looks good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, actually, rotation. So specifically the transform stuff. It's always that trick of like, oh yeah, I need to transform into this other coordinate space. So I need to like translate and then back translate, or I need to back translate first and then rotate and then translate. And like you always get it screwed up, and you sort of
try
it both
for me,
ways.
That's why I bust out that piece of paper. Yep. Very high tech,
okay,
but very effective.
If I can add a tip to your list of
sure.
tips for, you know, being a tools person,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's very important for us to have custom views work inside the layout tool as well.
Right.
And where this really breaks is when people start mixing in app logic in their custom views, right? So in mm-hmm. the constructor of, let's say, a sign-in button, you actually do stuff with talking to a server, right? That's really, really
non-view
bad.
Non-view things.
Yes. So it's you really want the widget to sort of only do widget things with a widget model. And then your app can configure it with app data. But don't start putting app logic into your custom view because, A, it's probably bad design.
And B,
it makes this widget not reusable. But yeah, B, more importantly, it doesn't work in the tools.
Right.
If you have to do that, you can actually call a method in the views called isInEditMode. That is a method that returns false, basically, unless you're in the tools. So on any phone, device, emulator, whatever, it's going to turn false, so that code won't run. But in the tools, it basically will be true. And so what you can do is, if you really want to leave your custom view doing all this crazy stuff that requires you to be in a real app, just make it so that if you're in edit mode, you return instead. So it's in the tool, put in some sample data and return, and then an else clause, you can do what you do at runtime.
But in general, I like the idea better of just having that logic outside of the view. Because view should be something that you view, you look at. It's something that renders on screen rather than, let's go also secretly fetch some data on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, how bad would it have been if the widgets in Android were tied into and had, like, you had to pass in the corresponding activity and fragment, and, you know, that would have been a mess. You really want the widget hierarchy to be sort of in isolated.
Oh, that's one thing I want to point out. I don't know why it took me so long. But inside the view class, you can go get context. You do not need to pass in the activities already there. But sometimes I actually do get the string out of the resource file.
Yeah.
Right? So then you use the context for that.
Yeah. No, resource lookup is totally fair.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're like, wait a minute, what rule are you going to break?
I heard something about passing an activity, and that scared me.
No, that's bad.
Yeah, just to get the context. Yeah.
Just to get the context. So it's already there. Like you can actually, you have access to the context without passing in an activity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the separation of concerns. There's the logic of like, well, let the visual things do the visual thing and keep your logic somewhere else. But then there's the other reason to do it, which is you're probably causing performance nightmares, right? So if you're doing these expensive things and going off and querying the database while you're creating or inflating your view, then you're also causing jank in your application because you basically stalled the UI thread until this non-UI related thing finishes, right? So every reason in the world, in the Android world, to not do that. So you had mentioned earlier that you also had dealt with a bunch of text view stuff. I don't know if that was for talks or some of the stuff that you've been doing in the apps and consulting that you've been doing.
So the way I approach talks is sometimes I will propose to speak about a topic because I want to spend some time learning about it. And then I use that as a motivation once the talk is accepted. So for the text view case, it was actually like that. I've like dabbled in it. I know that spans are very powerful. And so I really wanted to spend some time doing it. But like, I use it a little bit in my consulting job. I didn't really have a lot of really real world cases that I really need to use like fancy spans. So I submitted a talk. And then once it accepted, then, ooh, okay, let's go play with it. And hey, you laugh, but it actually worked out really well. I didn't actually cover, in the end, I didn't cover a lot of spans because there was a separate blog post that was really well written about all the like background span, foreground span, all those things.
Could you just copy the text and then just put your own name at the top of that? Would that have done it?
I put a slide that has the URL and said, if you want to learn about spans, go here. But now we are going to actually write some custom spans. So those are the system level spans. So I wrote some custom span that one of them I thought was really fun was that I did a rainbow span. Which
Before you get any further, can we just pretend for a second that I'm not 100% familiar with what spans are?
Sure. So if you know HTML, for example, that is a markup language. It allows you to, instead of just having plain text, say that, oh, I want this part of my paragraph to be bold. So spans serve the same purpose. It allows you to say, okay, from character 6 to character 200, I want it to be italic. So that's the basic idea of a span, is a subset of a text, and you can have essentially metadata about it. You may want to make the font size bigger, you may want to have its color being different, or you can just replace it completely and put a cute cat on it.
How does the styled text, I think there's an API for that, right, in Android, where you can sort of, in your rstring resource, you can actually put some limited set of HTML tags around text. And then there's a separate call. Like if you just call getText, you'll get the plain text. Right. But there's a separate call for getting that back as a styled text. I can't remember what it's called. Is it called styled
text? HTML.fromHTML. I think that's what I use.
Okay. I'm not 100% sure, but okay. So is this what the spans? Is that how you would obtain one of these, or do you build them programmatically?
So there are multiple ways to make spans. So you can build them programmatically. Like the easiest way is what you did, actually, specifying with tags in your XML file, your strings.xml file. And then when you get string, it will actually just interpret a limited number of them. But then, actually, I'm not 100% sure anymore. Now you confuse me. I think you still need to go through the HTML.fromHTML function, which interprets the HTML tags inside and then convert them, I think, under the hood into spans for you. So if you have like a, what do you call this thing, an angle bracket B, and then close angle bracket and something, and then you just close it, that will convert that into a span that will make it bold. Alternatively, what you can do is you can have a string, and then you can assign spans to it. So you can, like what I said earlier, you can say from character 4 to character 8, I want the foreground color to be pink. So that's like you can use Java code to specify that as well.
So what's the typical use case for this?
Do we have to be pink? I would like it to not be pink. Can we use a different example?
What do you have against pink?
I don't want to go there.
Purple's
okay.
Well, what's the main use case? The one I can think of right away is like, hey, you want to show something as a like with a link characteristics like blue and underlined, so people know to click, right? But what are some other cases where you want to do span text spans?
Emoji. Well, okay, so that's kind of the extreme example where you are instead of showing text, you're actually showing images, so you can inline images within the text view.
I like the way you said emoji. Like, I think that's how everyone should say emoji.
I know.
It's a very exciting.
It's not emoji. It's emoji. Yeah.
Well, that's actually kind of like in my talk, that's the build up. Like at the very, very end, because people have that in their head. Like, why would I learn to do all these things? And for me, the motivation is to be able to embed images inside. But there are other cases.
I still want to make sure I understand that. So I have a string.
Right.
Hello world. Right? Mm-hmm. And I want to put a smiley face in between those two. So I would still have it as a string, and I would use this in a string place, like a text view.
Yes.
But you're saying that there's something I could do where I insert spans, and I can actually insert an image somewhere in that span, and that gets rendered by...
magic.
Is it limited to images, or can I put any crazy hierarchy of stuff in there, any set of views?
So the way it works is if you define your own custom view, no, sorry, not custom view, my other topic, your own custom span, then what it does is hand you actually the canvas and you can draw on it, I think.
Wow.
Let me just think about it more carefully.
In part two of our podcast.
I was like, I should have brought my slides. I should read them because that's how I give my talks usually, not in a vacuum. That was one example that I gave in my talk where you are taking a drawable, actually. So your span is going to be drawing an image. And that image is something that you can define, so you can draw whatever you want, and then it will insert it. Of course, you still have to respect the height and width. So right, you have text, and suddenly you want this Mona Lisa picture in it. And you can still do it, but you just have to
override. It'll just be Mona Lisa's nose,
Right, either you can display just a nose, or you have to override the dimension to tell Android that, well, actually, this is going to be really big, so we have some like teeny tiny text and a huge image, and then some teeny tiny text again.
It's going to be like the old web pages. You remember that, right? Like text, and then the image was sitting baseline aligned.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's beautiful. I miss those days. So, but to be clear on what you were asking for, so it's not like a hierarchy of views within this thing. It's a text view with graphical objects.
Yeah. And you're getting some sort
most of
callback.
Which are text, but you can have some arbitrary images in there as well.
Oh.
Right. So not a view hierarchy, but a graphical thing hierarchy.
Is that because text is rendered from like some sort of glyph cache, like a texture map, and it just pulls the characters from there, and so you get to
it certainly is. Text is, but that's sort of a different topic.
Okay, like so this is not some way of being part of that, of saying, hey, this character maps to this special thing, which is my emoji character. I'm sorry, emoji. No, how do we say it?
Yes, yeah. Emoji. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, just as long as you're excited, I think that's what you needed. If you're drawing arbitrary images as part of that, I assume that that's going to go through a different rendering path where we're drawing images. But at the GPU level, it's kind of the same thing. Like when we draw characters, the first time we see it, we will draw that into a bitmap that gets uploaded as a texture.
So at that point, it's all images.
Into the glyph cache texture. And then it is essentially an image. And the next time you draw that character, we say, oh, we already have that uploaded in the GPU. Here's where to grab that part of that image from. And then we draw it into place. And then in the meantime, Mona Lisa is going to be cached as a separate image somewhere. We're not going to take like arbitrarily huge images and stuff them in the middle of the glyph cache. I don't think we're going to create glyphs out of these arbitrary images. So I think that probably goes through a different rendering path, although I haven't dealt with this specifically. So I'm going to say I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. So texture. So we've battered around a little bit already. The talks that you give. You also have a newsletter.
Yes.
That you where you talk about giving presentations.
Right.
So what is that about? How did that come about?
That's an interesting story there, actually. So what happened was that I was speaking at a conference with a friend, and we were talking about how difficult it is to get into public speaking, like what conferences are looking for speakers, and once you get accepted, what makes a good talk, what makes the slides engaging, and things like that. And somehow newsletter is a thing now. I don't know why, but suddenly there are a lot of newsletters popping up.
It used to be a thing like 20 years ago,
right,
I guess.
Yeah. Things, everything's a cycle.
Is it chainmail? That would be awesome if you could like frighten people into reading.
Yeah, people otherwise. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Has never been broken.
We ended up doing a newsletter partly because we have seen other public speaking help sites that just look very stale because they try to include, this conference is looking for speakers, and then that conference happened 2 years ago. So I feel like we can get away with a newsletter by having it have a date associated with it, and we send it out, and it's stale. It's like, duh, yeah, it's associated with that date. And also having that newsletter means that you get it periodically. So some people, they have good intentions. They have a New Year resolution. Oh, I'll go to the gym. Or some people, I'll give a tech talk, and then it never happens.
Some people just commit to the tech talk, and then they figure out if they know the material.
Well, this is a perfectly valid technique. So what the newsletter does, it points out, I call it curations. I only put in one or two conferences that I recommend people to submit to, which is kind of funny because people will come back to me and say, you missed this conference. And I'm like, well, I never meant to include everything under the sun. I think people who get started at speaking, they didn't realize how many speaking events exist out in the world. So they think that because I included two per week, like it's comprehensive. So maybe I should just set the record right here. So the newsletter includes 2 to 3 new conferences that we see at that time that we think is interesting for people to submit to. And then it gets into a link roundup, which is just things that we see on the internet that's related to public speaking. So a lot of it is about how do you write a good proposal, or if you need to travel to a conference but you don't have the money to go, does that mean that you can never go? I mean, the answer is no. There are ways to get some conferences will help you out and things of that kind. Or some things will be something that you never thought about, like don't wear a patterned shirt because when the video comes out, some artifact will make it look really weird. So it's a variety of links that is helpful for public speaking.
Let me just make a note on don't wear shirt. Okay, good.
Hey, you missed the keyword. and then we'll have an inspiration, which we usually include like a video that we find inspirational that maybe you would pick up a technique. So one video that we included was very interesting because in the middle of the talk, the screen went blank. And we thought that's a technical difficulty, but it's not. She purposely put in a blank slide so that you will stop staring at the screen and focus on her so that she can make an important point. So there's a lot of interesting techniques that you never thought about until you see someone do it, and we want to bring that up front in the newsletter.
So are the conferences, the links that you put in there, you said they're curated, like you actually know that conference well enough to recommend it? Because there are a lot of conferences that come up, like people will, ask if we can go speak at a particular conference, and I've never heard of it, even though it's local. Like, you have to wonder, like, is this really a developer conference? Is it sort of business focused? Like, what is the intent of the technical talks there?
Yeah, so what I do usually is when I see a new conference coming out, I will go to the previous year's schedule and see who spoke there and see if I know them or if I have people that will know them. Maybe they work in the same company or something like that, and I actually ask for a quote. So I ask them, hey, you spoke at this conference last year. Do you mind sharing a sentence or two of your experience? And then include that so that other people, essentially the subscribers, can have a little bit more information, right? Because if you go to the official website, of course, they're like, this is awesome. But
or if you just look at the speakers, you might get the wrong impression. Chet and I spoke at a conference once. I think we had, what, 4 people in the room?
And 2 of those were us.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so like they will usually come back to me and tell me that, oh, this is a very small conference, but the people there, because it's single track, people get to really dive deep into topics. So things that you can't really glance out of a schedule and understand, right? So like a lot of times you just see titles of talks. Like, what does that mean? Like, does that mean that people there, are the talks going to be very pitchy, like people are pitching their own products, or this is going to be technical deep dives? So I try to reach out to previous speakers and see, well, a part of it is also how they are treated as speakers. Some conferences really pamper their speakers. Like that. I went to...
Ooh, tell us more.
I went to a conference in Sweden. They took us out to sauna. That was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, also you kind of bond with the organizers when you go to sauna with them. But yeah, so like they went... They hosted a dinner at the city hall with the mayor giving the speech.
Wow.
So, yeah, so there are conferences where they go over the top to welcome their speakers.
So I was going
to
say, I was going to ask if you had any favorite conferences. I think we already have our answers.
Yeah, I like that one. That was really nice. So I include those notes in the newsletter as well.
And then speaking tips as well, is that mostly through the links, or do you clearly care about this and analyze it to some extent? Do you come up with, you know, tips for people who are trying to get into this?
So the way I do it is, if it's going to be tips from me or my, I guess I want to call her my conspirator. But
go ahead.
My co-editor. If we have tips from ourselves, then we'll write it on our blog and link to it, just not to break the format, because otherwise it would just...
And to get that sweet ad revenue, right?
Oh, yeah.
So speaking of that, you've also, Chet, written an article on how to your speaking presentations, right? Have you linked to that in your show notes? Because was it on Medium or something? I remember seeing something
like
60,000 word article.
20 articles
in one
piece. I remember
that. I bookmarked that.
It's too long.
I didn't get myself to read it right away. I did read it eventually, but not right away. That's a good question. I think you wrote that before the newsletter started. We may or may not have included that. I shall look at the article.
Sounds like a great
way to
addition.
Embarrass
this
the
sounds
guest.
Like,
hold on.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. And also, the thing is, like...
how many of our talks have you featured, you know, as examples of exemplary presentations?
Right.
Next question, please.
Yeah. No, but seriously, the thing is that... these things actually come and go. Like, some weeks, everybody writes about public speaking, and I have more links than I can include. I usually include about 5 of them, so we backlog them. Some weeks, it's just barren. Nobody wants to talk about public speaking. So then we will go into maybe older articles.
Yeah, if there's nothing else to talk about, you could link to Chet's article.
That's not what I meant.
So we're just coming up to I.O. now. That's when this is being recorded. So it could be that we'll get to the other side of I.O. and I have, again, way too many opinions about this topic, and then I'll regurgitate them out onto Medium. We'll see if I have more. I don't know. I kind of exhausted all my ideas there.
Basically, your idea was
I read it. I thought it was
improv,
a very good article.
Right?
Despite what everyone else says, I thought it was a good article.
I didn't get all the way through it. But what I read was, I glanced through it. So that's actually what it started with, was like, here's why I don't rehearse and why I think that's a valid way to give presentations. But the further I got into it, it's like, well, there are other valid approaches that other people, right, you know, should take given what they're trying to accomplish or whatever.
Right. So. Well, and also it's not just – there's a difference between you don't rehearse and you don't prepare.
Yes.
Right. So you should definitely prepare. But some people find it – nerve-wracking if they don't know each and every sentence that they're going to say. I am on the complete opposite end. Like, if I have a script, I am really worried that I'll forget one sentence and then I'll lose my place. So I don't do that. I don't even do speaker notes. I have slides. Well, the thing is, I kind of tweak my deck to my advantage in the sense that I give talks with walls of code. So I can't really... I mean, that is my script, right? So I have a wall of code, meaning 10 lines of code, because you want to make the font size fairly big so that people in the last row can see it. And then I can look at the code and I will remember why I put them there. And I even will sometimes highlight the interesting bit, and I'll be like, oh yeah, by the way, remember to call this, for example, remember to set the dimension of your drawable before you try to draw it. Otherwise, it'll be 0, 0 and nobody can see it. Right, so I'll see it on the slide and say, why do I include the function to set the dimension? Because it's important, right? So I will prepare that way and use that to guide what I'm be talking about, but I will not write every single word out and then memorize it. That actually stresses me a lot if I needed to do that.
Yep, Yeah, I mean, there's clearly people that want that comfort, but then if they don't rehearse it enough, they end up either reading the speaker notes or looking up into their forehead to try to remember what it was they're going to say on that slide. And I don't want either one of those, right. Which is why
I have to kind of say that. It also depends on what kind of talk you're giving, like the technical talk I give, because I have an overall kind of storyline that I'm just following, so I don't really need to rehearse as much. I've also given Ignite talks. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a 5-minute talk with 20 slides, auto-advancing every 15 seconds. So the format is super, super strict. And you have to time it perfectly. So that I will rehearse a lot more. But I still don't remember every single word I'm going to say. I will know that each slide, I have enough time for 3 sentences.
Right.
So I will make sure that I pick my 3 sentences well and remember what are the points I want to make within 3 sentences and then do it.
Yeah, I mean,
you're doing the speechless stuff, speechless format now, and I.O. again, I guess.
Yep.
Yeah. And that should really be very good practice for this idea of just seeing the slide and then formulating a plan immediately and then executing it without having... You know,
not only
do you not know the material, you really just have to be able to pull off something that is convincing to the audience with no preparation.
I think the best advantage of doing that is not so much that like the practice of, you know, making it up. It's more the knowledge that when you make it up, it will be okay. Like getting to the right. other side of things like that, or just more practice on stage where, you know, your language, the words you're using at the time are spontaneous. And you got through the presentation, you covered the material you wanted to cover.
That is actually a very good point. Like, having the experience of messing up, like things not going to what you think will go, and surviving it.
Yeah.
That's, for me, the most important thing. Knowing that you can go off script, and it's okay.
Yep.
Nobody's going to know that you go off script. They did not see the script. As long as you have, like, the main idea that you want to give, you gave it across, like, that's going to be fine.
And there are clearly forums where it is appropriate to memorize. So the keynotes, so the Ignite talk, I think, is a great example. Mm-hmm. I haven't given one of those, but I could see memorizing things because there are these marks that you want to hit very specifically
right.
in a talk like that. Keynotes are exactly like that. There's particular messages. There may be particular phrases that you want to use. And there it's going to be very important for you to actually memorize at least those key phrases, if not the entire thing, right?
Right. So I was in the keynote 2 years ago. And you have such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
You have like 2 minutes. And you can't then sit and, well, what did I want to say now, right?
Because
it takes
time to wander around.
Even for a normal talk, it takes you a minute to warm up,
yep.
right? And you don't have that time. So then,
right.
you know, I knew exactly what I was going to say. Not word for word, but exactly sort of what each...
No, you got the rhythm down.
Yeah.
Yep.
You have to have that.
And I've done that for same sort of, you know, small bits in keynotes in the past. And then the other one that I got into in the article is like the difference between improv and stand-up. Improv, you're making it up at the time.
Right.
And that's more like what the presentations are that I give. But stand-up, it's highly,
routine.
Highly scripted,
yeah.
right? Every single word and order of everything matters, and therefore it's scripted and it's rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed.
I just saw Jerry Seinfeld
yep.
A couple of weeks ago, and I heard him do a bit that I've heard before.
Yep.
And it was
and it's exactly the same?
Yep.
It was exactly the same.
And it sounds so spontaneous and natural.
And it came in, but it's like, wait, this bit I've heard before. And it was exactly the whole thing again. So it's, they do that.
Yeah.
But of course, it's great if you don't.
You can pull it off and look
yeah.
like you're not going on
yeah.
word by word of a script, because that's very boring if you're just like doing that, droning on
yep.
and getting on the script.
All right, cool. I'll have to check out the newsletter. I saw you tweeting about it. I haven't actually checked out the newsletter yet.
You
I just
have
knew
not.
That this was. Now it gets awkward for me.
Yeah.
Well, the next one, which
checking out
features
your
article, I mean, you're going to have to.
That's right. That's
right.
It's a win-win. What else were we going to talk about? You talked about an app that you wrote for learning Chinese.
Yes.
So is that related to the text stuff that you were? No, because the text view stuff came from, like, I want to give a talk on this topic, right?
Yeah, I did. The app is called Monkey Write. Teaches mostly children how to write Chinese. And I did that first thing basically when I went independent, and the text view was much later. And what the idea was that a lot of people will learn Chinese and then they will talk and they will listen and they can have a conversation, but they don't put in the time to actually practice writing Chinese. And there is no way around learning how to write Chinese. You have to practice a lot. So the way I structured the app is I want to make it fun. I want to make it a game because it's mostly targeted for children. And you have to actually unlock characters. So you have a workbook. So for example, the zodiac, so all the animals in the zodiac, and you have to learn the first one word first, which is mouse. So you have to write it, and the app grades you, and it gives you 1 star, 2 star, or 3 stars. If you give you 1 star, you have to try again. You have to do at least 2 stars before you can move on to the next character.
So 1 star is fail. That's again for kids. You want to have some reward even when it's terrible.
Well,
great participation.
Yeah, I think I say great try or something like that. Good
try. It's a one-based array. Like zero is really one.
Okay. Yeah, so then, but if you get a 2, then you can pass on to the next level. But 3 is difficult. 3 is perfect score. You don't make any mistakes, then you get a 3. And that, I put that in on purpose because somehow people really wanted that 3rd star. Like, it's not something material or anything, but that 3rd star, they will just keep writing and writing and writing and writing until they get the 3rd star.
I think this is an opportunity for in-app purchases.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, can they buy their way out of this?
That's right, just like Candy Crush, you know, like you want that level 60.
I'm not sure mommy and daddy will be paying for that level.
They don't have to know.
That's right.
I see. Yeah, and the funny thing is, like, so I will show this app at a party, for example. People just have met me. They don't know me. Say, oh, what do you do? And I tell them, I'm an Android developer, and this is one app that I did. They are not learning Chinese or anything, but, like, 5 minutes later, I will see him still working on that character. I really want that 3rd star.
What is that draw app that was so successful? It's kind of like that, right? I mean, if you see a shape and you're supposed to replicate it. So it's almost like a memory test, even if you're not trying to learn the...
Right, so it's actually more than just the shape, because writing Chinese character, you also need to write in a particular order.
Oh.
That way it will structure the character so that it looks better. Actually, when I was a kid, when I do my homework, the teachers can see after the fact that I wrote it in the wrong order because the structure will come out wrong.
Hmm.
So the app grades you not on just if you can reproduce the shape, but also the stroke order and the direction, so whether you're going the stroke from left to right or right to left.
Hmm.
So it detects all that. That's why the 3rd star is so hard to get, so I actually need to know how exactly to reproduce that character.
Was the ordering wrong, or was it that you didn't translate after you did the rotation?
It's a nice callback.
So I was also thinking that the advantage to this sort of, you know, especially the grading system where they advance and advance and advance and they're sort of motivated to keep going is, like, you picked a perfect language for that, because as far as I understand it, from my understanding of Chinese, there's an infinite number of characters there.
That's wrong.
Wasn't it infinite? I thought it was infinite. No. Tor, how many characters are there in the Chinese language?
I have no idea.
Because it's infinite.
It's infinite.
No, I mean, like, for daily usage, you don't really need that many. I don't have the number top of my head. I think you can read a newspaper with 1,000. Don't quote me on that. But it's definitely
that sounds more like USA Today.
1,000. Just think about it. That's the thing called Unicode, and it's finite. So.
Yeah, all right.
I don't know. I thought they just kept expanding. Like Unicode, like this is why they have an annual conference on this.
There's a Unicode 5.0, right?
They're adding more and more and more to it, and it's all about the Chinese language and the number of characters in it. One of the tests that we had to hammer on some of the glyph cache work, like for about 2 or 3 releases, I kept working on glyph cache optimizations. And one of the reasons was that language. Somebody wrote an app where they basically just injected new characters all the time, and then you would sort of scroll this list and you'd get all these new characters on the screen. And after like 2 frames, it would just bog down. It would just die.
That's a bad implementation of a list view.
Well, no, this was not the list view's problem. It was basically they were asking for new characters all the time because, again, I'd like to return to this, Chinese language has infinite number. And eventually it would blow the cache.
On this, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. We're going to be corrected.
Like they will tell me exactly how many Chinese characters there is.
Slightly less than the number I quoted, but pretty close. You know, as far as the cache was concerned, it was infinite. It basically could not handle that many characters flowing into the cache. And so we had to, you know, work through various algorithms to, you know, have a bigger size or do more intelligent flushing or whatever. But because those languages have so many characters compared to
maybe you can dial your estimate back to like long.max value or something like that.
We could. We'll look into that.
Yeah.
I don't work on that cache anymore, so not my problem. Okay, so that was Chinese glyphs. You wanted to talk about tools. You did.
Oh, that's right. Yes. So you're an Android developer, and you write all kinds of apps. I mean, I think you've done something with Wear as well. I see you have your watch face out.
Yes.
So what's your development environment and tools and practices?
I use Android Studio.
I was so relieved. I was so afraid you were going to say something else.
No. Yeah, I pretty much use the standard tool. I'm not very adventurous. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have to confess, I didn't adopt Android Studio until 0.5.2.
Oh, that's highly respectable. I mean, that's like, pre-beta. 0.8 was beta. So 0.5, that means you are, you know,
like it was
one of elite.
Every week.
It
like,
still
I
is.
I have to. Well, the thing is, no, the more like the definition of the Gradle file was changing every week.
Oh yeah, no, the Gradle plugin changed incompatibly on a regular basis.
Yeah, so I was waiting for it, yeah, like the complaints to die down before I adopt. But once I did, then I'm like, why was I even using Eclipse before? I don't get it. But yeah, it's really nice in terms of, I love the completion. Like that's the thing that saved my life. Basically,
the editor,
I don't have to remember things. But that's mostly it, and then I deploy from the green little button.
Okay.
I think the inclusion of Gradle in Android Studio is kind of the tools equivalent of like the Linux kernel. Like, yeah, you can have that distribution as long as you actually, you know, develop the kernel yourself and rebuild it. Like that's, you know, it's sort of required. If you want to use Linux, you know, on the desktop, here's how you, you know, build the source code or read the source
you
code in order to figure
support?
Out how to
Okay,
build.
We'll just rebuild the kernel.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
This,
right.
Like...
Write your own driver. Why do we have to provide
that.
This for you?
When I first like Linux box, I have to recompile the kernel so that the Wi-Fi
there you go.
Work.
Yeah. So Gradle in Android Studio was bringing that joy, especially during the alpha and beta periods, was bringing that joy back to hardcore developers. Like the errors that I would get from the Gradle, like, you know, the format of
like,
this thing changing.
We were talking about speaking at technical conferences, I do remember, you know, a while back now, I will admit, but, you know, all the Linux people frantically running around asking, hey, does anyone have a good working X11 config file? I can't get the projector to show my screen. You know, that was the perpetual problem. And I haven't actually seen that complaint from anyone the last few years. So I think that Linux has solved this, but that used to be a really fun part, was getting your laptop to actually project.
So that was the big tools discussion. That was it. It was just like, yeah, I use Android
really
Studio.
He really wants to make sure that I'm on Android Studio.
Well,
and
yeah.
There
was that.
I was,
you know, some people, all, you know, have a lot more of additional tools they use. So I was just wondering if there's anything else that, well, if, you know, you have your own issue tracker that you use, or actually you use Android Studio, but you also use TextMate or whatever when you edit. I was wondering if it would.
I see.
But, you know, sounds like you're stuck Android development tools. And that's a highly respectable answer.
I even like recently I installed this thing I think called Key Prompter, which every time you do something with your mouse that has a key shortcut, it has this really big gray ugly pop up that says, "Do this other thing instead.
Yeah.
Like, press this button instead," so that you.
That's
don't
a plugin for IntelliJ, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very good one because it basically teaches you the faster way of doing things, and you know you can save a lot of time.
And I've been trying to learn the shortcuts with no success until I installed that. Then it really shamed me into remembering, okay, Alt-4 to get to the Android tab. No more clicking.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that's another answer to the question that I was asking about last time we talked about, like, how do you learn all these shortcuts? I guess you get software to nag you.
Yeah. It works surprisingly well.
Okay.
There's also, if you go into the help menu, there's a productivity guide thing.
I printed it out and pinned it on the wall. I never looked at it.
Okay.
It was a PDF. Is that the thing you're talking
no.
about? Okay, not that.
There's that too. There's a feature in there which basically it tracks what features you've used, and so it shows you like, hey, look at these things you haven't used. So it's basically it's a way to sort of be exposed to, and I think it does some estimates for how much time you've saved on the features you did and so forth. So it's just, you know, check the stuff in the help menu. There's some.
It's like UI
analytics.
Coverage.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah,
kind of.
Like
yeah.
Code coverage for.
But sharing it with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh. How about libraries?
What do you mean?
Are there particular open source libraries that you tend to use to accomplish certain tasks?
Retrofit is a great network library. Like the fact that you can pull stuff from the net and it will convert it to just Java objects. You don't have to deal with the parsing of the output is great. That's kind of my go-to thing. Like when I need to talk to a JSON backend, I'll use that. Espresso, I really like. Espresso is open source. Like, it's from Google, but it's open source. So it's still.
I hear that there are teams at Google that do provide products that are open source.
Right.
I've heard of that before. I'm sure I've heard of that for some products around here.
I can't remember which podcast it was, but someone interviewed those people. So you know, that might be something you should search for and see if you can find.
Right, yeah. So I use that quite a bit for testing. I like that.
Tor mentioned your watch face that we saw that you have developed. So tell me about writing watch faces.
This is
that for another talk?
Crazy. Maybe. That's definitely a blog post coming. But so I started actually looking into it maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, like very, very recently. And I went to, surprisingly, on the watch face, there's actually a lot of documentation. Somebody wrote, like from, I think even from Google, there were like two different sample apps. Like one is from a collab where you can go through and put your own image in it. And the other one is more like a catalog of different things you can do. You can make a digital watch, you can make an analog watch and things like that. So
I know we integrated templates as well. So you can go through the new project wizard and say, I want an analog
clock. I was so pleasantly surprised because I'm so used to poring over documentation and hitting my head on the wall and trying to figure out how to do things. But the watch face actually surprisingly easy. That was really... the only thing that was tricky for me was that I have to deploy by Bluetooth to my Moto 360 because it's not USB connected, which I'm used to just ADB device and it will show up and then you can just push it. So you have to do this trickery, which is you have to turn on Bluetooth debugging on both the phone and the watch, and then you have to do this TCP connect thing on the shell. And I did not turn it on my watch because I need to press something for 7 times before I can become a developer. Anyway, so that was like a really long chain of steps I need to do before I can deploy, and I missed that. So I was just getting really frustrated, and I finally figured it out. But once I passed that step, it was actually very, very, it's fairly straightforward to do. And of course, the other reason why I find it straightforward is like when it comes down to the actual watch face, I am given a canvas. And from my experience doing custom view, I know how to deal with a canvas. So I know how to put
it. You got out your piece of paper.
Right, exactly. This time I didn't do any rotation. All I needed to do was put the text in the middle. And you have to compute, you have to measure the text and to know how big it is. So that, because I'm not using layouts, because at some point I'm just handed a canvas. I could have an off-screen layout and render it. And then, ask it to render. Basically call dot draw on it and pass the canvas that was given to me by the watch face interface. But I didn't. I was actually doing draw tasks. Before I did, I have to measure it and put it in the center. And so, and it was actually, I just pushed it to the store, my watch face.
Cool.
So I was very, very happy that I could essentially from development to beta test to push, it was 5 days.
Wow.
But it's a much smaller form factor, so there must be a lot less code involved, right? Like that screen, whenever I look at my way, it's far smaller than my phone.
Once you get to that part, you're right, it's not that much code. But the surrounding setup where you have to get the manifest file right, and like, for example, to push it to the store, I have to make sure that, so there's a carrier app. So when you install a watch face from the store, you don't install the watch face directly on your watch. You have to have a carrier app that installs on your phone, and then the phone Bluetooth it over to the watch, right? So you actually have two APKs. One is the Wear APK that get embedded into the mobile APK.
Into the Mule, yes.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So then you have to make sure that both APKs have the exact same version number, have the exact same package name, and have the exact same set of permissions. Initially, I missed the permissions because like the watch needs a particular permission to be a watch face, but I didn't realize that the carrier app also needs to have that. So you know, there are little hurdles here and there that I need to jump through. But overall, developing for making a watch face was a pretty pleasant experience.
And had you written live wallpaper stuff before? Because it's heavily based on that, right? It's basically wallpaper.
Yeah, that I was struggling a tiny little bit. No, I haven't done any live wallpapers.
Okay.
This is
having not done that, it wasn't that big a deal.
No, it was. Like I said, the fact that there is code that I can just compile and run and then base off that existing code was very helpful. I mean, there's one thing to read documentation and the other to have a complete code repository where you know you can just hit run and then things will work. That gives you the confidence that now I can muck with it and change it and add my own things and then it will work rather than just maybe I'm doing something like terribly, horribly wrong.
So that's also, that also explains why the Google logo is still on your watch face.
Hey, right? It's a cute cat. Come on.
Google logo cat.
That is not a Google logo.
I'm out of topics, I think we're probably done for now. Anything else you want to talk about?
Can I say the name of my watch face so people can download it?
We'll put a link to it. Go ahead and say the name.
But it's called FitCat.
Happy to put the link in the blog post as well.
That's like an exercise app for cats?
No, it's a cute cat. But eventually there will be some fitness component in it. That is going to be version 2.
It was all about drawing the cat at the right size to actually fit into the smaller form factor.
There are actually there are multiple cats that you will see on it. Some of them are chubbier than others.
I see.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And then they're too big for the watch face. So if you get 1 star, then your cat is too fat. But if you can get 2 stars, then it barely fits in. But what you really want is 3 stars, and then you'll get the next cat to draw. Is that?
There is some other kind of motivation form in it, which has some ties to fitness. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe by the time this episode airs, I will have launched version 2 already. Who knows?
Who knows?
You're committed to that now. You used a commitment device, so now again.
Right, and then I will have the fit card ready.
You have to go and build something related to fitness because you said it here.
Yep.
All right.
Good luck with that because we're posting this tomorrow. Better be ready.
All right, then.
All right. Thanks for joining us.